Well, hello, this is Jeff Gagliosi, and you are on MisplacedStraws.com, where music comes to life. And my guest today could very well be the coolest chick in music. You may know her from amazing records like Balls and Welder, and in my opinion, one of the great records of the last 20 years, Exodus of Venus. Or maybe you listen to her show Apron Strings daily on SiriusXM's Outlaw Country. But either way, you should know who Elizabeth Cook is. She's on the road as we speak, so please welcome Elizabeth Cook. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
And now, it's been about 3 years or so since Exodus of Venus came out. You've done a lot of touring over that time. Will we see new music soon?
Yes. Yeah, so we're trying to get it set up for next year. So that's like all the kind of information I really have right now, but I'm super excited about it. I will say that.
Oh, definitely can't wait to hear it. Are any of the new songs in the set this stretch of touring?
Yes, for sure. And I'm always playing new songs like that aren't out yet, no matter what, because I'm always sort of working on them, and I like to spend some time with them before I record them, because once you record them, they're going to be on that record forever. So the more time that I've had to bat it around, especially on solo tour where it's bare bones and you really sense the good spots and the not so good spots, and I like that process a lot.
And now on this tour, is it a solo tour or do you have a full band with you?
This is solo tour.
Oh, great. And when it comes to writing, how does your writing process work for you? Do you write on the road? Do you set aside a certain time each day, even when you're home, or just wait till it comes to you?
I am always writing, really, because to me that is taking in things a lot, as well as like putting them down or together. So something I see on the side of the road or a word somebody says, any kind of stimulation, really, that intrigues me. Mm-hmm. I keep record of it constantly and stew on it. And then when I just am jamming on a guitar, sometimes those little snippets find their way into a musical realm. And then I can build the song out from there. And then there's songs in different phases all the time. Mm-hmm. There's like just things that are scraps of words and thoughts. There's four lines at a time that are written. There's songs that have one verse so far, and I don't know where they're going to go. Songs that have a verse and a chorus. So songs in all of those stages. And when it comes time to make a record, I have to sit down and really gun, you know, to get organized and quit screwing around. But
kind of like work around those ideas.
Yeah. And so, like, for the next record, it was this last December, in scheduling, we were going to start recording in January, and I only had about six songs that were really tidied up, so a bit mountains of everything else. So I had to just isolate myself and not do anything during that time and not see anybody, and my job every day was just to focus on those songs.
And, you know, your records, and for anyone that follows you, your Twitter account too, are really personal. And, you know, Welder's the reference to your dad, and most of Exodus deals with just everything you were going through in those intermediate years. Is there anything that's kind of off limits for a song for you?
I mean, only when there's people still alive that it may impact, then it's touchier or it requires some consideration. But even like just yesterday, and I think I posted in my Insta story, I just wrote like a stanza, and it completely outed the fact that my grandfather was murdered by my grandmother and they buried the body and covered it all up. And
oh my God.
Now the people that, you know, were in, directly involved or aware are all gone. And it's just sort of the grandkids and stuff, yeah, you know, that I can now, you know, allow to know about that, mm-hmm, part of our family history. It's just a little too close to home for that generation.
Mm-hmm.
So I would have never done it then.
Yeah. And, you know, as we mentioned earlier, I absolutely love Exodus of Venus.
Thank you.
And it's a bit of a change in your sound. You know, your first few records were more of the traditional sort of Dolly and Loretta country. And Exodus was a little more of sort of kind of the Jason Isbell, Alejandro Escovedo, outlaw country vein. Did you set out to change your sound, or was it just a product of where you were and what those songs became?
Yeah, definitely that. And two, you know, when I was making those country or records, mm-hmm, nobody in my sort of arena of country music world or music world in general was really doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's like a lot of people doing that.
Right.
But nobody really was then. And so I was a little bit of a lone wolf in that way, and it made it harder to find people to tour with and, mm-hmm, you know, all and outlets for it and all those things. And I never deliberately sit down and go, I'm going to make a rock record, I'm going to make a bluegrass record. I don't. If anything, if I dictate that at all, it's only to get across the vibe of the song and the point of the song. And so I want, mm-hmm, the instrumentation to continue to extend that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why, that's how that happens for me. So Exodus, you know, is super foggy. I was on another planet. I had been through a series of traumas. I was on heavy psych meds, and I didn't feel of this world. And so I very consciously wrote those songs, but overall, that's sort of where I was floating, and that dictated how it needed to sound. There was a rock aggression to it, mm-hmm, and there was a despondency to it, an ethereal vibe to it. So I wanted all the sounds and the instrumentation to extend that.
What did you grow up listening to?
Mainly just my mom and daddy's band. They had like a honky-tonk, mm-hmm, band in Central Florida, so I knew all the songs that they did, which was Hank Williams and Buck Owens and Loretta Lynn,
mm-hmm,
that kind of music, just barroom, you know, music. And so I grew up knowing that. And we had a few records, but not a lot. Mm-hmm. And when I turned 12 or 11, MTV came on the air, and I was exposed to more music, and boom boxes became a thing, and I got a boom box, and there was a radio station in Orlando that played just pop music. So I started hearing Prince and, mm-hmm, Michael Jackson and all those things. And I had ordered a record off TV called Neon Nights, because I was a big Rick James fan and didn't know it. But I really liked, as a little girl, you know, if she's a very freaky girl, I'd jump around and dance to that. So I really love that music, and
yeah,
my first non-country concert was Madonna on the Like a Virgin tour with the Beastie Boys.
Yeah, with the Beastie Boys, and
you always hear
stories of how well the Beastie Boys went over in certain parts of the country that just had no idea what they were.
In Orlando, just because nobody had ever heard that kind of music before, and nobody knew what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't understand it. It wasn't like they were booed or anything. It's just everybody was kind of confused. They were in Mickey Mouse ears, because I guess they'd gone to Disney World that day or something, and like jumping around all over the stage, yelling No Sleep Till Brooklyn, and it's like, what's happening?
Well, you know, it's funny, you know, hearing you say, especially with the advent of MTV, and you kind of get exposed, you know, because we're about the same age, and it's, you know, the same thing. When you saw all that other music, you got exposed to stuff from outside of your little world. And one of the things you did on Letterman that I still think is one of my favorite performances of all time is that cover of Pale Blue Eyes. And, you know, that song, just, it's one of my favorite songs anyway, but, you know, your version of it, you know, and it's weird to think that, you know, the Velvet Underground is such a New York band, But, you know, here you are doing that cover of it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, so the other chapter of that would just be that, yeah, me, when I moved to Nashville and I got a publishing deal at Rise Homes, and we hung out in that office a lot with a wall of vinyl and the Towns Van Zandt catalog and Lucinda Williams. And I never heard of any of those people. I mean, it's so such a cultural void in terms of like what you're exposed to than just by local big country radio stations all there was. So I just discovered a whole other layer of musicians and people that existed on another plane, like Todd Snyder and Chris Knight. And so I got really into that, and that sort of helped inform, like, okay, I think that's like where I fall in this. And I'm so glad and grateful that I had that experience that continued to open up kind of layers of music to me. It's been really cool, really cool. And then I was married to a guy that lived in New York for a long time and knew the Velvet Underground. He had Velvet Underground cassette tape. And I got really hung up on the song Sunday Morning.
Yeah.
And I recorded that on the Balls album. And then David Letterman actually hit me up and knew, to find out if I knew Pale Blue Eyes. And I totally didn't, but I said that I did. And then he was like, well, will you come to the Late Show and do it? And I was like, yeah, I will. And then
of
I was
course.
Like, Google, Pale Blue Eyes.
Yeah, I mean, it's just such a beautiful song. You know, it's very cool. Now, let's talk about Apron Strings. SiriusXM Outlaw Country, noon to 4 Eastern. How did you end up doing a radio show?
I was on a press tour kind of for Balls album. And I was at SiriusXM doing a special for Outlaw Country. And they, Jeremy Tepper, who's the boss there, he asked if, and he was interviewing me, asked if I wanted to do a radio show. They were looking for a female that would sound like she belonged on the country station to talk. And I was like, no, I don't want to do a radio show. That sounds like more work, and I don't understand it. And he said, well, just do a little audition, just so we'll have it, just in case. And I was like, okay, so I did something, and then he got me to do one day a week, Fridays, and then he was like, will you do Thursdays and Fridays? And then it turned into 5 days a week 10 years later.
It's a great show. I mean, as someone who didn't grow up with country music and really doesn't know much about that world still, I discover a lot listening to your show. So it's, you know, I definitely enjoy it. And, you know, kind of along those lines, what are your thoughts about kind of where country music is going now? I mean, like the new Sturgill Simpson, it's a brilliant record, but I don't know if you'd really call it country. And God only knows what Zac Brown was thinking on, you know, the stuff he put out. You know, I mean, do you have any kind of thoughts as to where you see the whole thing going? And a lot of it is coming back to that traditional stuff like you were doing early in your career.
Yeah, I mean, more than I consider genre or somebody that is, you know, we have to organize it somehow, I guess, and so I understand the need to do that. But I also consider the most important thing about music to be if there is an earnestness to it. So I really don't care if something is a banjo or an electric guitar with distortion on it. It's more about the intent and the vibe that it brings me. And sometimes those two instruments in the on the right song in the right way can do the exact same thing and have the exact same effect. So I just don't believe in confining ourselves to those trappings. I think it's limiting, and I think it's unnecessary. It's only because they're trying to monetize and everything that I feel like this need to categorize it and define it, and also because people seek validation, I feel like, through music. And some people in country music especially is really almost made a mockery of this, but people that are looking for their identity,
right?
And they give you something to aspire or affirm, that affirms something about you, and then they know what to try and sell you and what you're going to buy. And I really think that's a lot of it. They'll list, you know, and so country music is so, you know, gross about it now. It's like they just list off things. It's trucks and dirt, and everybody knows it's an old joke at this point. And then they tell you the things that go with that. And it's manipulative, and it sells people short, and it bastardizes the art form, and it's unfortunate.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, at the end of the day, a great song is a great song. It doesn't matter what genre you try to call it in. But again, in terms of monetizing it and what could we sell, they'll try to hammer it into the genres.
Yeah, and then people that look for their identity are like, I like bluegrass. I'm this person.
Yeah.
You know, I subscribe to this, and this is not only the music I listen to, this is my lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
And so some people attach to music in that way. As to me, where it's always more of an emotional journey, and Jimmy Cliff can do the same thing as Waylon Jennings for me.
Exactly. If it's the song, you know, if it's a great song, it's a great song, regardless
and
of
a great performance,
what you want to call it. Yeah. And Mike corrected this, that you have actually played the Grand Ole Opry more than any other artist who hasn't been invited to join.
Yeah.
How is that possible? How have they not?
I don't know. I don't know. They're scared of me, or I'm like, press on the radio.
Do you
something.
Freak out the establishment that much?
I think I'm a little. I don't know. I really don't know. I don't. You know, I've got fans that I feel like, you know, want to start petitions and stuff, but I don't really. I don't want to say that I don't care, but. You know, the Opry is part of what I do. It's not all of what I do.
Right.
It's been super important to me. I love those people. I know the parking attendants. I know the people at the desk. I know the ushers and their family. And when I go to play the Opry, it's about that and standing on that stage and playing music. And the ribbons you know, taglines and all the stuff that can come with it. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I would get, like, health insurance or something if I had that. I don't know. But I just don't really care about that type of.
Well, because you're there and you're playing it anyway, and I think that's what matters.
Yeah, I mean, achievement in those terms, I just don't. I don't care. I care more about you being impacted by Exodus than I do being a member of the Grand Ole Opry.
Well, and so, you know, I made my first pilgrimage to Nashville about a year ago, and, you know, the Ryman blew me away. I mean, the sense of history was just overwhelming the minute you walked through the door. I think even more so than the Opry building itself. You know, I mean, if you had the experience of playing the Ryman, and, you know, I mean, what was that like the first time you walked on the stage?
Oh, yeah. You know, it's overwhelming, and, and I think you try not to dwell on that. I mean, people paid money to get in, you know, focus on your performance. But I couldn't help but look and see the light coming through the stained glass windows up top and near the rafters, and just the visual of all the images that I've seen of the Grand Ole Opry over the years, and people gathered outside in the night that Hank Williams did Lovesick Blues six times, and people sitting in the windows. And I can't help but that movie played in my head. So there's that aspect. There's also the sound of the Ryman, which is like its own instrument.
It was unbelievable, yeah. When I saw my first shows there last year, I was just amazed by it.
Yeah, so it's really a fun room to play because of how it sounds. So that's really a cool thing about it, too.
Well, it's funny. When I was there, you know, we did the tour during the day, and it happened to be the day that the Birds were playing that night. So as we're doing the tour of the Ryman, Marty Stewart's standing on stage. I'm like, it really doesn't get much better than being, you know, touring the Ryman while Marty Stewart's taking pictures
probably with
on
Chris
stage.
Dillman and Roger McGuinn.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, Roger wasn't there. Chris was there. Roger's backstage, I guess. But it was pretty amazing.
Yeah, I went to that show, and I cried.
And now, a few weeks back, I do an interview with Beth Hart, and I asked her a similar question like this about sort of the rock and blues world. But in the world of country, what's your view on women in country? I mean, we've heard how hard it is to get on country radio for women, and, you know, the big award shows are usually male-dominated. We're seeing a bit of a change now with, like, you know, the High Women and Tanya Tucker's great record. What have been your experiences in that?
Well, more challenging than I care to admit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really only in recent years and more so in recent months that it's come home to roost more, where my understanding of it, because I don't think about my gender that
mm-hmm.
much. Then right, I don't care about genre. I just don't think about it.
You're right.
But when I start to collect experiences that, and some of them not good, and look at like career blocks and things like that and realize that they are because I am a woman, that's difficult to
mm-hmm.
swallow. And it's not just the guys. It's sometimes the guys' wives. And, you know, it's just that can cause you to not be able to do something. Like, it's wild. It's stunning because I think we consider ourselves such a liberated society.
Right.
And we have all these amenities,
mm-hmm.
and we appear free as can be. But we've got sort of some cultural habits that are mm-hmm. real seriously oppressive.
Yeah.
For all minorities.
Mm.
And it's tough. It's tough.
Yeah. Well, I know you have a show tonight, so I won't keep you too much longer. Again, thank you so much. I know you're hitting the road. The dates are up on your website. What's next? You know, you mentioned a record at the beginning of next year, and I'm sure the radio show will still be going. So just kind of
getting the whole machine
up and going.
I'm screwing around on Instagram all the time.
Yeah.
I'm going to, you know, probably like
mm-hmm.
hang out with my dog at the beach, see my family for the holidays,
yeah.
take up another hobby
yeah.
maybe, all those things. There's always breaking news, you know, and things that are going on that I can't talk about yet. But it's cool. I'm looking forward to everything. I feel good.
Well, and again, I encourage everyone, check your website. There's a whole list of dates going through December. You're just kind of kicking off this leg of the tour. They could catch you every day on SiriusXM's Outlaw Country, and I highly recommend your social media accounts. They're great. And I'm looking forward to catching you tomorrow night in Northampton, Mass. So, buy a shot at the bar if you throw in Broke Down in London. Putting that out there. But thank you so much for taking the time, and best of luck in the future. We'll see you,
thank you.
See you tomorrow
Thanks,
night. Yep.
We appreciate it. Thanks, man. I'll see you tomorrow.
You got it. Thank you.
Okay.